you a high performer, obsessed with growth, and looking for an edge? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. Together, we'll discover underground secrets to unlocking the full potential of your mind, body, and spirit. We'll learn from some of the world's leading minds, from ancient wisdom to cutting-edge tools and everything in between. This is your host, Nick Urban. Enjoy the episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. This week, we're joined by a fellow Czech practitioner. His name is Mike Salemi, and Mike specializes in human performance and is a sought-after international presenter in the field of health and fitness. Mike has a diverse background in strength and conditioning and has competed over the course of 15 plus years at an elite level in powerlifting and kettlebell sport. Through his own path of resolving sport-related injuries, Mike understands the importance of integrating the body, mind, and spirit as a means to foster high performance for the long term. His motivation is to help athletes, fitness professionals, and coaches discover their own potential from the inside out. Professionally, Mike has served as a Division I strength and conditioning coach for Santa Clara University, as well as serving as the trainer to elite athletes across a wide range of sports. His focus is teaching educational workshops, certifications, and creating programs on unconventional training to build optimally balanced athletes. But if you're not an athlete, have no fear. The principles we discuss translate to anyone wanting to improve their quality of life via fitness and movement. We cover some of the basics of training, as well as the mindset and approach to viewing your fitness program through the lens of a movement scientist. The links to everything we discuss will be at mindbodypeak.com/78. And if you're interested in perusing some of Mike's work, you can go ahead and access that at mikesalemi.io, mikesalemi.io. The way you move and your mindset around movement is core to living the highest quality possible bioharmonious lifestyle. And before we get started, I'll leave you with this takeaway I had from our conversation. Movement, fitness, and workouts aren't about destroying the body through taxing workouts or complicating things for the sake of complications, but about increasing your ability to do the things you want at a higher level and for longer. This conversation with Mike should empower you to do exactly that. So sit back, take some notes, and try implementing some of this into your own life. Mike, welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance.
What's up, Nick? Thank you so much for having me, brother.
Like always, it's a pleasure. And we will start today with the unusuals or non-negotiables you've done for your health and performance.
I mean, over the years, it's continually evolved. I don't want to say it's evolved, but it's just it's changed with different phases in my life and as different relationships have come in. But I mean, the non-negotiables for, I mean, at least the last 15 years, the first thing that comes up is food. I'm not as crazy as I used to be. I used to be like a 95.5 guy or like a 99.1 guy when I was competing. Now I allow myself a lot more freedom in that area. But that being said, for me, as much as possible, like choosing high quality organic, choosing food that comes from farmers that put their love and their care into the food, that for me is one of my biggest non-negotiables. I mean, it's even gotten to the point where whether it's on traveling and such, if I really can't get high quality food, sometimes, you know, I might have to make an exception, but for the most part, I am totally fine fasting if it means skipping one or two meals so that way in the next meal or so, I can actually get some nutrient-dense food that doesn't F up my gut. So the first thing that comes up is around diet.
Yeah. Yeah, I can relate. When I'm in the area where it's a food desert, such as going on a plane or something, and they pull out the snacks that are highly processed, very shelf stable, certainly not organic, I tend to skip those and I will eat a higher quality meal later, just because I know what that is. And I know what that'll do to my metabolism and body.
Totally. Yeah, it's a big thing, especially when traveling. Like for so long, when I would travel for work and stuff, like if you're eating food that messes up the gut, like it always affects my brain. It always makes me more tired, foggy headed. And usually I'm traveling for work. And so if I've got to be on, whether it's for a podcast or teaching a certification, a workshop, whatever it may be, I need to be feeling really good. I don't want to be having gas and ripping farts during the day. And so the food is probably like the most important thing during travel. And I'm totally fine with fasting if it came down to it.
Yeah, because if you have a bad meal, a say high glycemic meal, then all of a sudden you're on that roller coaster and you get energy dips and spikes and you get the brain fog that goes along with it, the fuzzy head, the inability to remember things, and it's not worth it. Versus fasting might be a little bit of a stressor, but at least you feel good and you're not impairing any of the systems. And then once you're able to get high quality food, your body is able to absorb and assimilate it pretty effectively.
Absolutely. That's been my experience for sure as well.
Well, help me and my listeners know a little bit about you and what you've been up to in your background.
Sure. You know, the way I always like kind of starting off this question is I always started as an athlete. You know, that was like the biggest time in my life that I remember the lessons that have still carried me through today. And, you know, so from 7, 8 years old, being a gymnast, I competed for years in competitive powerlifting at an elite level, Olympic weightlifted in college, kettlebell sport for 10 years. And all during that time, you know, I believe that when you are pushing yourself at any hard level, like the risk of injury goes up. There's no doubt about that. If someone's pushing themselves, honestly, the volume that's needed, pushing beyond your limits, getting out of your comfort zone, there's a risk with all that. And for me, there's risks also in life. And so I learned a lot about myself and how to approach risk. And even in my approach to being an entrepreneur today, I really feel like everything that I learned in the weight room and in the athletic area, it's tremendously supported me. But all that to say is, in those sports, when you're pushing yourselves at that level, I did get injured. So I got injured in different ways and multiple times. And every single time an injury came up, it was a turning point in my identity. It was a turning point in how I learned to care for myself. And so much of my approach towards training, performance, mindset today came from, as one mentor of mine, Paul Check, would say, is the pain teacher. Yeah. And so because of those teaching moments, I was able to figure out a system that genuinely worked for me, but not just worked for me in that moment, but was a holistic system that now could support me 10, 20, 30 years down the road. So what I do today truly comes from being in the trenches, from getting injured and coaching now thousands of people. And so my philosophy on training, performance, mindset, men's self-development, I would say the roots of it stemmed in the athletic room. Hmm.
So your transition from more of the powerlifting, Olympic lifting, bodybuilding, the aesthetic side over to a more functional approach to movement and exercise, that seems like it stemmed from personal necessity.
What feels really true for me right now is I think it stemmed from curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was in powerlifting and the transition from powerlifting to Olympic weightlifting was I had reached a high level, but I knew if I wanted to reach the level that I really wanted for myself, there was going to need to be a decision made. Like there was going to, I was either going to need to do steroids and compete at a higher level, or I could be at my current state and go far. But in powerlifting, for example, like there's multiple organizations. There's not one unifying body, and each organization has different rule sets, different equipment or gear that you can wear. And for me, I was really curious at that time to see what else from an athletic standpoint, from a sport standpoint, is out there for me in a way that like I wanted more, I don't even know if I want to say like more of a pure test of my strength, because it's not that powerlifting wasn't pure, but I wanted something that I was curious to see what my body could do in an organization that's like, there's only one. And so when you win typically like a world championships or Olympic games or a national championship, you are the national champion. Whereas in powerlifting, you could be a national champion in 10 different organizations. And it's like, for me, that always didn't feel the best. So for me, I was really curious to see what else was there. What could my body do? And could I challenge myself in a way that promoted a deeper level of growth?
I see. When you're designing a training program, or when you think about movement for yourself, are there any particular patterns that you like to prioritize, say like squatting, pushing, pulling, that kind of thing?
Depends on where I'm at. Like right now, to be honest, I've had a knee issue that's gone on for, I don't know, the last maybe like 5 years or so. And so I got to be mindful and I do some rehab for it and stuff like that. But I do now a lot of lower body, a lot of single leg work. I do some bilateral, so two-legged squats and stuff like that. That's fine. But what I really find is like squatting and lunging has been the best things that don't bother my knee and actually help rehabilitate it. So I do a lot of lunging, a lot of squatting. And then also just from what I've learned over the years, especially with tools like the Bulgarian bag, the transverse plane, so rotational movements, is a huge part of what I do. So it kind of depends where I'm at. Oftentimes, like, I'm a creature of novelty. Like, I love new stuff and getting creative. So what I find is each tool, you can train in multiple planes. You can do multiple patterns with damn near any tool. That being said, certain tools are going to be more conducive to certain patterns and certain planes of movement more than others. So as an example, Bulgarian bag is probably the best tool out there for rotation. If you're using a barbell, you're really not going to do much rotation. So I kind of go in phases in terms of where's my weak points, what's exciting me. If I've been doing a whole block of 6 to 8 weeks of Bulgarian bag training, or predominantly bag training, I might switch it up and do a month of barbell training, squatting, deadlifting, and more kind of fundamental movements. So depends where my heart is and where my excitement is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly we'll cover some of those technologies and things to incorporate in a diverse training routine later. But are there like fundamental patterns that all humans should be able to do to some degree, such as you mentioned rotation, and obviously squatting is a big one that you'd be required to do before we had the conveniences of modern life and that kind of thing?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, to be an effective, efficient human, a healthy human, you need to function in three planes of motion. So that's the transverse, which is rotation, the frontal plane, which is think like side bending, lateral movements, side to side movements, and then the sagittal plane, which is front to back. So that's going to be like your squat and your deadlift and forward lunging. That being said, within those three planes of movement, there's also seven, what Paul Cech would call primal movement patterns. And so that's going to be similar to what you were saying. So squatting, bending, pushing, pulling, rotating, gait patterns, and lunging. I think that was the only one I missed saying. But if you take any complex movement, take like a baseball pitch or throwing a ball to your kid, you can dissect that movement down into its component parts and find some or multiple of those primal movement patterns encompassed in that. So for example, when someone does a throw, whether you're throwing a football to your kid or you're throwing a baseball in a baseball game or whatever it is, what happens is first you step out and you have the lunge pattern, you step forward. Then what happens is you twist your trunk, so you have a twisting pattern. And then you actually have the release of the hand with the ball, and that is some extension of a pushing pattern. So for that activity, and to be a human, you got to do damn near every single activity on the planet. You got to be able to climb stairs. You got to be able to carry suitcases. You got to carry things off the floor. You got to be able to push someone if someone gets in your face. And so we can look at it from the perspective of every single activity that it takes to be a human is contained within typically those seven movement patterns or some combination of them in some way, shape, or form.
So if you were, say, a baseball pitcher, would you want to train and focus on the relevant primal patterns? Or does it make sense to train everything and maybe just slightly emphasize particular patterns?
It's going to depend on the individual. It's going to depend on where their weak points are. It's going to depend on what phase of training they're in, where they are in their season. So for example, if someone is, if a pitcher, which is not uncommon even in young boys today, like they don't have an off season. So they just play. And if they're throwing a lot, typically their shoulders or their pec is going to be overstretched, overtrained, burnt out. So in that situation, if I've got an overtrained kid with a shoulder injury or something like that, or just a burnt out shoulder, I'm going to need to do a lot of things to correct that. I might not do very much pushing in that phase. So for me, when I'm starting with someone, it's always about taking an assessment of where they are orthopedically, yeah, structurally, seeing, taking into account things like their training age, taking in things into account such as their body balance, how they can move in these things, what activity do they do most often. And the main thing that I'm first trying to do is put someone in a greater state of balance. Even if that is the pattern of their sport, and I know that we need to excel them into that so they can throw the pitch harder. But that being said, if their shoulder's going to give out in one or two or three more games, doesn't fucking matter how much I build up, you know, or give them a pushing pattern or something like, yeah, that. I need to get their body in balance. And in order to do that, I got to see where exactly they are. And then I can strategize a game plan based off of their weak points and their volume and all sorts of stuff. So it depends, you know, and that's why I think this is one big missing element in many fitness programs or sport programs, is the failure to look at a conditioning program in different phases. Most sports, most people are in a what would be called like a performance phase, mm-hmm, 365 days a year, but they don't have systems or a strategy to back down from that, to rebuild the body, to allow the nervous system, to even allow the mentality and the psychology of the person to recover. So their body may be good, but the kid has just been playing, you know, 365 days or whatever of baseball, starts fucking hating the sport or hating, quote, his dad who's making him do the sport. And it's like, he could be a physical specimen, but if he hates it, that's going to come out in multiple different areas, either a quitting of the sport, a lashing out, being reactive. So all of these things, in my perspective, need to be considered truly for like a holistic program for anyone, whether it's a kid or an elderly person, you name it.
Yeah. And holistic and functional programs sometimes get looked down upon because some people say that, oh, you can just prescribe or assign in your training program the same things for everyone and it'll work. But as you were mentioning a second ago, if you say give someone a squat who isn't ready for it, has an injury or something, then by continuing to train that same pattern, you can just lead them down the wrong route and exacerbate imbalances and cause more harm than good.
Yeah, I would agree for sure. You know, it depends. Again, it all depends on who's the individual that we're talking about. And I've never been a fan of like generalized programs, but that's just my philosophy. But also, like, I'm in it to win it. Like, I'm in it to be better each day. And like, I my background's competing, and so I'm there to be better each day, not just be average. And yeah, so I think it depends. And I'm not saying people want to be average per se, but a lot of people are okay just doing the same thing every day. And if as long as they're not getting injured, and, you know, there are safe and good programs that can fit the majority of the population. But if we look at it at a deeper level, you know, even beyond the physical level, how is the physical program supporting their mental health, their emotional health, their spiritual health? Is their training routine, when they go off just to kick their own ass in a CrossFit workout, is it an escape from dealing with issues in their life that they don't want to look at? So in a holistic program, for me, the word holistic, it not only has a holistic from a physical standpoint, from looking an assessment, seeing where the weak points are, really fine tuning that program for that person, but it also holistic means the body is a system of systems, and everything affects anything. And so if we're overtrained, or if we have, we're going through an emotional challenge, our workouts and all those sort of things, in my opinion, it could be very highly beneficial to consider those facets if we, again, want to use physical training as a means to develop the whole person. That's mainly what I'm interested in. And I know that that's not for everyone, or that mindset is not, and that's totally cool. But I utilize physical training as a means to develop me and the clients that are attracted to this philosophy in their entirety, as opposed to just getting not just, but like just building a bigger bench press or bigger biceps. Like, what's the why of that? Why genuinely do we really want that? And if it is, you know, something that is going to be really supportive to them in their entirety, then fuck it, let's go. But I think just simply being curious and asking the questions can be highly beneficial.
Yeah. And I know from my own training, that's certainly poignant, that when I'm feeling stress from other things in life and I go and I push it, my recovery suffers a bit, takes me longer to recover from the same thing. My fuse becomes a little bit shorter. So it's just like, I've learned to listen to my body when I have either sleep really poorly or I have like a fight of some sort, like the emotions run wild. Then I like to incorporate that into my training plan for the day and possibly long term if it's a prolonged stress.
Yeah, I hear you on that, man. Yeah, that's what's looking at training as a whole human being.
Yeah,
which is beautiful, you know. And again, there's going to be for general wellness. If someone wants a general wellness program, I think there's definitely safe ways to approach that. But that being said, even within general wellness, there can be like specifics and like there can be a little bit more customization and personalization in simple ways. For example, like if you're really burnt out, you didn't sleep all night, even if it's the same program, maybe just reducing your volume and the number of sets that you do. So even if you stayed on the same program, how you approach that program or your rest periods, maybe you take longer rest periods, for example. Like there's certain things that you can adjust via reps, volume, rest, sets, all that sort of stuff that can make a generalized program more specific to where you are so that it actually helps move you forward and doesn't drive you deeper into deficit.
Let's dig into that. Let's dig into your holistic approach to strength, conditioning, rehab. And if someone's deciding on a program, they want to customize it to where they are, what are some of those design factors that you recommend considering?
The foundations of health are obviously super important. So like the water that we drink, our sleep, our movement, our food, our breathing, it's all super important. But when I think of what really affects me the next day and in my program, having reduced sleep or a really wicked night of sleep, like I'm about to, my fiance's, we're about to have a baby in a few months. And like, I know that my sleep is going to be really compromised. And so I already know just from the years of that I've put in the gym, I haven't never had a kid, so I don't know what that's going to be like exactly, but I just know the sleep's going to be really compromised. And so when I've been really tired, like my nervous system feels very sluggish and slow, and I'm going to be a little bit more vulnerable. So am I going to try to max out on a barbell snatch or do like, you know, kill myself in the gym? No, I'm going to approach the training as like proactive maintenance. Movement, irregardless for me, movement, irregardless if I sleep a lot or not, movement in general is huge and I think is important every single day. So I imagine that my training in that point when I'm going to be more sleep deprived is going to look more like walks twice a day, 20 minutes of movement. I'm probably going to do my volume, the number of sets and reps that I do, no matter what type of program I do, is going to be modified. So sleep is huge. Some of the other things, I mean, I do think that digestion, food, if we're, for example, inflamed, bloated, if we're retaining water, those are all things. Like, for example, I was competing, I think like it was a month after a trip that I had to Italy, a work trip. And before I went, Paul had told me, he goes, you know, just be really mindful like of the gluten that you're eating out there. So if you eat pasta and stuff, and he knew that I was already really sensitive to gluten. And so what happens is when there's inflammation in the organs, it will downregulate our ability to actually stabilize our spine because the organs are going to take precedence. So he was telling me like, if I eat a bunch of gluten and I'm sensitive to it and I start retaining water and I inflame my system, I'm not going to be able to hop right back at the level of training that I was before the trip. And so he's like, it could set you back 7 days, 10 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And for me, I was competing heavily at the time. Mm-hmm. So I needed to either know that that would be a consequence and my results in competition would go down, or I could just not eat the gluten and just avoid the pasta and still able to maintain a little bit of integrity and more stability when I'm lifting. So The food that we're eating and its effect on our body, absolutely important. You know, it depends also if it's an online program or if it's an in-person program. If it's an in-person program, breathing is one of the first things I look at. And so that will also impact someone's ability to stabilize their spine and how they deal with stress and how quickly they gas out and burn out. So breathing is absolutely critical. I also look at things like motivation level and how someone's managing their stress, because all of that stuff, in my opinion, needs to be taken into account for, again, a holistic program that will support someone irregardless of where they are in life and irregardless of what goal or objective they're trying to reach.
I remember when I was getting certified via the Czech Integrative Movement Science program, I learned that gluten-containing foods can destabilize the core for a period of time, even among the people who think they are not sensitive. So the instructor went around assessing core and guessing who had consumed gluten recently and was able to pretty accurately predict whether someone had consumed gluten or not.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And then also with your programs, do you implement regressions and progressions of basic movements depending on someone's training age and skill level and other factors?
100%. And that's also another way, going back to, is there a program or is there things that everyone can do? The knowledge of progressions and regressions is another way where you can take a generalized program that you could find online that's maybe written by someone who knows somewhat what they're doing, and you can customize it via the progressions and make it much more personalized to where you are. So for me, the knowledge of progressions and regressions is absolutely huge, because that's how we actually educate the nervous system. You know, for example, if I was teaching someone, to make it really simple, a clean and jerk with a barbell or a clean and jerk with a kettlebell, one of the things that I can do is regress that movement and chop it in half in what's called in the Czech system, oftentimes chunking down the movement. So you're doing that. So I got to first make sure that they can do a press. Then I got to make sure that they can do a push press. Then I got to make sure that they can do a jerk. That would take care of the highest level of progression on the clean and jerk for the upper body component. Then I also got to make sure on the clean and jerk that they know how to deadlift, that they know how to clean. Deadlift, swing, and clean for a kettlebell. If they can do those three movements, those progressions, then now what we can do is then we can combine it. So I can chunk or regress movements into its component parts. And then based off of where that individual is, then I can choose the adequate level of progression for them so that they keep progressing. And also too, because when you're looking at progressions, let's take that same example. For example, what I tend to see when someone tries to do a kettlebell clean or a kettlebell clean and jerk, they don't understand the movement pattern quite well, how to stabilize their spine, how to move through their hips. So they could spend all day weeks or months trying to master the clean, but the problem could be actually two or three steps back. So I could get someone to understand how to stabilize their core and stabilize their spine with just a deadlift. And if I just spent 5 minutes on that, then take them to the clean, it's amazing at how many problems we can solve if we actually solve them at the level that person is at in that moment. So the knowledge of progressions and regressions is absolutely critical. And I think that is a very easy way to take any program and scale it up and scale it down on a moment's notice based off of where you're at.
Mike, you said something interesting a second ago that I want to underscore and highlight. And that's, you mentioned the role of the nervous system in all this. And I think that a lot of us think of going into the gym and training with barbells or dumbbells or even kettlebells as mainly a way of building muscle. So how does the nervous system fit in?
So every muscle has either one or a series of nerves that basically control it. And for me, the more intelligent the nervous system, the more intelligent the entire body. And so when we're talking about movements like kettlebell movements, Bulgarian bag movements, one of the things that make those such effective tools is they require multiple what's called biomotor abilities. So multiple, let's just say, performance abilities. So like coordination, balance, speed, power, strength, endurance, flexibility. So all of these things the greater combination or the greater increase in any of those, especially in the coordination area or balance area, the smarter the nervous system is going to be. And that's what's beautiful about training with kettlebells and Bulgarian bags. Again, nothing super against machines. There's a time and a place for it. But that being said, your nervous system, your computer system, which regulates the entire body and controls the entire body, will not be nearly as skillful as you would if you were training these complex movements and stuff like that. There is a time and a place with isolated training, and I think they benefit each other. But the smarter your nervous system, the higher level of skill you'll develop, and then the higher level of transfer you'll be able to carry over into day-to-day activities, into your sport. This is why if someone was just only doing isolation training, again, there's a time and a place for it, but if you tried to take pure isolation training, like bodybuilding movements more so, they're typically not going to be the best athletes. And what is an athlete, in my opinion, it's someone who has a high level of biomotor abilities based off of their sport, which takes a high level of skill, which takes a very smart nervous system. And that's also the keys for me to building a more resilient body. The smarter the nervous system is, the more resilient we'll be able to be.
Yeah. One thing I like to do when I go into the gym is take the traditional dumbbell bench and I'll modify it, and I'll take a kettlebell and I'll flip it upside down and it'll be bottoms up, and I'll do chest presses like that. And the next day I'll feel considerably more sore than I do if it's just a typical dumbbell. And I have to think that at the same time I'm training my nervous system in different ways. So it seems like it's a good approach to combine multiple different biomotor abilities and different types of movements like that.
I think, and just to make it clear, like complexity for the sake of complexity, I'm not a fan of. So for just doing a more complex or higher skill move just for the sake of it, doesn't make sense to me. But if it's the right progression for that person and done in a thoughtful and a methodical way, that's really what we're trying to achieve. And that's why, like, when people switch their workouts, for example, like every time they hop in the gym, they do a different workout. If there's a thought process behind that, great. But typically what I find is people don't give themselves enough time to master what they're actually doing. So they're basically like shitty at 100 exercises, and they're getting that variety. So from the psychology standpoint, if they like new stuff, that's great. But if they don't have like a well thought out program that's that is giving them that adaptability, or that is giving them that variability is what I was trying to say. That's giving them that variability, but within an overall game plan, then that's what we're really looking for. It's got to make sense. Like, and a lot of this stuff, dude, for me, it's kind of just being a rational thinker. Like, it's just like, does this actually make sense? Or is this kind of like a stupid way to approach things? Like, am I methodically progressing, or am I trying to jump from A to Z and skip all the letters in between? So for me, I mean, there's definite principles, there's definite program design, strategies and phasing and stuff. But for the general population, a lot of this stuff is genuinely just common sense and asking us the question and checking in with ourselves, like, how am I feeling? Does this make sense? Does it make sense to do chest hard? I was just talking to a colleague and kind of client earlier today, and he was doing a program and he was doing hard chest 3 days a week, but he's beat up his body like crazy. He was a former football player, had all sorts of injuries. And he's like, I thought it was great, but then, like, man, my shoulder started really hurting. And he's like, I had to back off. Like, I can't do 3 days of chest. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So a lot of this stuff is being inquisitive, being curious, being methodical, checking in with ourselves. And for the general population or the person who just wants to be fit, that can really give you a ton of answers in terms of how to modulate your training.
Yeah. And one of the big principles there is to not outsource the cues and the signals and different tells that your body is giving you to technology, to a hard-coded program plan, or to someone else who tells you what you should and shouldn't be doing, not knowing your backstory and your current status.
Totally. Absolutely, man. Yeah, we see eye to eye on that for sure.
Yeah. What about recovery? Do you recommend any like specific movements on days off or on like after a heavy, hard training day? Do you like any forms of like what's Paul Check calls working in or like restorative exercise?
That's a good question. So to answer it in one word, yes. And then to expand on that. So from the working in perspective, maybe I'll start there. From the working in perspective, from a way to accumulate energy that's been expanded or that's needed in the system, like energetically, spiritually, that sort of stuff, working in or gentle movements where we combine breath with movement, it's more of active meditation for me. That's applicable at all times. You know, that's something that's a part of how that's, I mean, even just like a walk outside, just nice and easy, a decent pace, breathing in and out through my nose. Like for me, that's working in. So that I apply it at all times, every single day, mindful movement, active meditation. And oftentimes if I'm training really hard, my days off will just be focused on that. Mm-hmm. Then there's also things like different tools and strategies like the sauna, cold plunge, sensory deprivation tanks, like utilizing some of the tools that can be really supportive. So I'll use those. And then also from within the session, there's also ways where, I mean, to set it really simply, every major muscle group, for the most part, the major ones that I train in a session, I'll do myofascial stretching for those major muscles. So if I did a lot of like walking lunges, for example, as the primary exercise or the main focus that I'm really stressed or that I'm feeling fatigued after a workout, I'm absolutely going to do a stretch for the quad or the rec fem, one of the quads, and I'm going to do a glute max deep. So the large glute muscle, I'm going to do 2 myofascial stretches for that. So I'm absolutely going to start restoring the tension in those areas, help the flow of water through the fascia, help normalize the tension. And then I always finish my training sessions with something called an LDOA, which is a specific type of posture to decompress particular joints. It's very specific. Mm-hmm. And so I typically, at the end of my session, you know, my recovery, that's a huge part of it. When I do 1 or 2 LDOAs at the end of a session, and I actually have a podcast coming out on this tomorrow, which is Thursday, where I interview one of the instructors of this method. And so much of what I feel was taken on during the training, the compression in the spine, the fatigue in the muscles. If I do 1 to 3 myofascial stretches and anywhere from 1 to 3 or 1 to 5 LDOAs at the end of a session, so like 15 minutes as a cool down, it's incredible how good I feel and how much more recovered I feel. So when I take that end of the session focus, when I take having a good diet, drinking water, maybe doing a sauna and a cold plunge, and then some active meditation like the walking outside, that's really, from a practical standpoint, those are the things that I actually do every single day. Like those are not things like, those are kind of like flossing my teeth. Like I don't go a day without some type of working in. I don't go a day without doing some type of LDO. I don't go a day without drinking water and making sure those things, the tissues are hydrated and moving well. So those are some of the big bang for my buck that are actually, there's one thing to like speak about it and there's another thing to do it. Those are things I actually do.
Yeah. I like that movement floss.
Yeah, totally.
Okay. And I don't think we actually defined what working in is and like how you can tell if something you're doing outside of a walk, because a walk stands for itself, but how do you tell if a movement itself is working in, or how do you make it a working in movement?
So this comes from Paul Check. And so anyone who's interested in that, you can, he's got a ton of stuff. I think he's got quite a few, I'm sure, blogs about it, videos about it and stuff like that. So I'll just preface his book, How to Eat, Move, and Be Healthy. And he's the one who first introduced me to this, but basically damn near any movement can be a working in exercise. And so a working in exercise is an energy cultivating activity. A working out exercise is an energy expenditure activity. And so we're all familiar with what working out is, but there is, to your point, there is some criteria that helps let us know if we are actually in a working in zone or in a working out zone. Another way to say it is working out is going to be more yang, more sympathetically dominant of an exercise, more stressful to the body, more stressful to the nervous system. It's going to be more catabolic in nature, more tissue destructive, for example. On the other side of the coin, a working in exercise is more yin. It's more nurturing. It's more rebuilding. It's energy cultivating. It's more parasympathetic. It's more recovery inducing. And so if we take the walk or even like a squat, a bodyweight squat, the way that you know whether you're moving into a working in or a working out zone, one, when you're doing the exercise, it should be linked and coordinated with your breath. It should be slow and you should not sweat. So if you start sweating, you know you're heading into a working out zone. If your tongue should stay moist, if your tongue starts drying out, then that lets you know you're not in a working in, you're in a working out zone. Your digestion should improve. So digestion is a parasympathetic activity. And so if you can do that exercise on a full belly, and as you're doing it, you actually feel like digestion is being stimulated, you feel better. That's why going on a walk after a long or a big meal feels so good. That's fantastic. That's working in. And then the other two criteria is your respiratory rate and your heart rate should not increase. And so if you feel when you're doing the breathing squats that your heart is just beating out of your chest, then you know you need to make some modifications. You need to reduce the range, make it more shallow. You need to go slower. You need to modify the movement so that you can actually control and stabilize your breathing rhythm and your heart rate. So those are about five criteria, and you need to adhere to all of them if you're going to be in a working in or a working out zone. And this is probably one of the biggest missing elements that I see today in most programs. It's going to our earlier discussion on most people staying in a performance phase and not really doing these other phases of training. Well, also, we can look at it more in the micro level. So we can look at training as a macro level or like in a year-to-year plan or in a six-month plan or in cycles, but we can also look at a micro, more microscopic level, and we can look at the individual training session or a training week, and we can look at, is there recovery or is there phasing even within a week? And so this is where working in can come in, because if we're just only hitting that working out zone, then what we're able to output and what we're able to achieve and how long we're able to do it is going to be limited. You need yin in order to express a more healthy and productive yang. That's just how the body and the system works. It works. If you don't eat, if you starve yourself for a month, you will not be able to put very much out in the gas tank. You're not filling it up. And so think about yin working in as we're filling the tank. Working out is we're actually expending and we're actually pushing our body in that sense.
That's a good point. So if you have a brutal day, say two a day, where you train in the morning and you take some couple hours off and then you train again in the evening, say sprinting or something that's also very taxing, before your next workout, it would make sense to fill the gas tank back up and implement some of those active recovery or working in type movements.
Yeah, totally. In general, that's a really, I would say, just a really smart thing. There's exceptions to everything. And sometimes what might seem like a dumb thing to do or doesn't seem rational, if it in the overall scheme of things makes sense, then I'll give one example. And this is I think Paul shared this on a DVD or he shared with me in a coaching session, but when he was coaching Laird Hamilton. So Laird Hamilton is one of the best surfers of all times. And normally when you start a training session and you program, you start with the most complex exercise first. Yeah. Because that's what's going to take the most coordination, the most balance. It's going to be most taxing on the nervous system. You wouldn't want to start with like, you wouldn't want to finish a session with like a Swiss ball exercise, right? You'd want to start with that early on because it's so complex, it's unstable. So for him, he actually fatigued him in the session. And then at the end, when he was already fatigued, he would give him a really hard, neurologically taxing exercise. And he did that intentionally. Now, this is Laird, a very advanced lifter, yeah. But he did that because he's surfing Mavericks, for example, these massive waves. And so if he isn't able in a fatigued state to maintain his balance, his focus, his coordination, then that could be a life or death situation. And so I just want to say with all this stuff, there is exceptions. But that being said, what we're talking about is more for like the vast majority of people. But even within that, like program design is always a mix of half scientist and half artist. And yeah. It depends who's in front of you and how you want to judge that as the coach.
Yeah. You always know that someone knows their stuff when they say there's an exception here, an asterisk there. It doesn't apply for some, for most people or some people.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about your approach and how you got into kettlebells and Bulgarian bags. Like, why did you decide to offer a lot of your trainings and programs around these?
Man, that started when I was in, when I was a collegiate strength and conditioning coach for Santa Clara University, their men's tennis program. I think that the real curiosity started then because I was having, I don't recall exactly, but between 8 and 12 athletes at the time. And I was responsible for conditioning the whole team. And I do remember, and this is going back, I don't know, maybe like 15 years or so. So a while back. And I just remember, I think, and I was actually having this conversation with one of my clients today, who's an elite Canadian volleyball coach. And we're with him, we're implementing kettlebells, Bulgarian bags, and the soupless ball over the course of 2 years with a lot of elite volleyball players in Canada, especially in Quebec. And we were having the same discussion. And what is ideal? Like when you're first starting out as a coach, there is the ideal and the things that you want to do. But then when you're actually in the setting and you're actually coaching, you realize what is ideal and what is realistic are could be two very different things. So if I've got, and he said the same thing, and this is why the kettlebell and the Bulgarian bag, as an example, are such useful tools and why I really have gravitated towards them. No matter how great an Olympic lift is, and I'm a huge fan of Olympic lifting, but if you've got 45 seconds with a group of, let's just say 10 kids, 10 collegiate kids, who are exhausted from their training schedule, who might have gone drinking the night before, who've got egos in the gym or always trying to outdo each other and who can lift more, and you've got and don't maybe have a background, that might be the first time in their life that they've actually gotten actual training knowledge and someone to break down the movements. Like oftentimes a lot of these kids are just great athletes at their sport, but never had someone in the S&C room to help support them from a developmental and rehab perspective. So with that, I realized really quickly, I was like, no matter how good the barbell clean is, I can't fucking injure these guys' wrists. These kids are implement athletes. If I jack their wrists up, no matter how great the benefits are, it's just not realistic. So then I started getting curious. I was like, okay, what are the tools that I can do on the court? What are the things that I can train myself at home that are maybe are easier to teach in some respects, are better for groups? I can do things that aren't as risky in certain areas. And when you take, for example, the Bulgarian bag, it's a soft tool. So if someone F's up even a kettlebell clean, that hurts. Yeah. Like that hurts the forearms and the wrists. Whereas if you F up on a Bulgarian bag clean, it's soft. And so what I find is people are picking up these movements faster. They're also oftentimes safer to learn, especially for beginners. Like I teach my mom, I work with my mom on the Bulgarian bag from time to time, and she's the opposite of athletic. I love her to death, obviously, but I would never put my mom in an Olympic clean. I don't have the time. She's not as interested. She just wants to, if and when we train, she just wants to spend time with me and I don't want to hurt her. Yeah. So I'm not super crazy or super, I don't want to say I'm not super thoughtful, but I'm just trying to get her to move. And I just want her to have fun and be safe. And so I've got 30 minutes with my mom. I know I'm not going to be able to teach every single progression to her. I got to keep her engaged. We got to have fun. So I think it started in college. And then with that, when I was taking courses and really learning the kettlebell, which was my window into the Bulgarian bag, I found out that there's an actual sport for this, kettlebell sport. And so two of the instructors that I had taken one certification back in, I think it was 2009, were kettlebell sport competitors. And they invited me into the sport to be a part of their team. It was the Orange Kettlebell Club. And I really loved it. And so, you know, fast forward 10 years, I've fallen in love with the kettlebell. And the Bulgarian bag is a really complementary tool to that. Very different. But someone who appreciates kettlebells and the functional movement and what it can do, it's like they fit, they support each other and complement each other like hands in a glove.
Huh. I've done a bit of kettlebell work and I find it interesting that people either in the gym gravitate straight to the kettlebells and these alternative fitness devices, or they steer clear and it seems like almost like a black box to be avoided at all costs.
Dude, that's so true. That's such a fair observation. And I think the people that avoid it, at least what I've seen is over the years, is it can be intimidating. When someone is lifting kettlebells and snatching and that sort of stuff, or doing these complex movements, it's intimidating. And a machine has got a little icon on the machine how to do it. It's pretty fairly simple if it's a leg press. So I think this is genuinely a call up to the coaches out there, because if you have a good coach who knows how to do it and who can introduce you to the tool in a non-intimidating and a safe way, like that's actually one of my greatest joys as a coach, is creating a safe container for people to learn this stuff. And so, I mean, I've taught all over the world, and I remember teaching in Kuwait, and I had ladies in there who were in full garb, and they were really intimidated to learn. Like, they don't oftentimes, at least my experience out there, they don't get to really learn these tools, or they're not, whether sometimes maybe it's not as accepted for women to train with these tools or to be in the gym. And so for me, I was such an honor to be there and to work with these ladies and teach them these movements, and to do so with a smile. And like, there's no, when I teach, like, there's no egos in this stuff. Like, I remember what it was like to start off and be bad at a lot of this stuff. And so for me, so much of what creates a learning environment is the safety and the trust that hopefully is fostered by the coach. So if someone is intimidated, my suggestion, if you're interested, you know, get a coach, or I've got online programs, very methodical, very slow starting off. But if you put in the time, it absolutely will pay off in the long run, and you'll develop a whole level of confidence that maybe you didn't even know was there.
Yeah, when you nail a movement that seems complicated and looks really cool, super rewarding. But I want to underscore what you just said. And if you're going to go the kettlebell route, or I guess a lot of the different lifting routes, you want to have either professional instruction or a course that'll actually like thoroughly guide you through it, not just take top five tips to kettlebell swing on YouTube or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. A program, hopefully, that teaches you. That's not just, you know, I mean, if that's what you're looking for, that's great too, like just a workout program. But when we're talking about skillful movements, movements that there is a risk to injury, you know, with all this stuff, like movements that actually challenge your nervous system at a high level, find a program, whether it's mine or someone else, that actually educates you, as opposed to just kicking your ass. I mean, it's not hard to kick your ass. Like, you could just do 100 burpees in a certain amount of time. You get a good sweat, and maybe from time to time, that's what you want to do. But if you really want to learn and develop skills and develop, again, a smarter nervous system and be more resilient, you got to learn how to do stuff right, you know? Yeah. And so sometimes you got to go one step back to go two or three steps forward. And it might be a slower approach. Like, my program and my philosophy is not for someone who just wants to crush themselves out of the gate. Oftentimes, it's going to take the first 3 weeks focusing on working in, balancing the body, learning the fundamentals. But if you put that in the long scheme of things, what I find is it's like, I don't know if the word is like a bell curve, but it starts off slow. But then once you lay down the fundamentals, you progress so fast. So if you put in the work and you stay patient for 3 weeks, when you get to 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you'll be blowing past people because you'll have the fundamentals, the body balance, you'll be working out the weak points, as opposed to trying to go hard right out of the gates.
And for someone that's been on this journey for a while and been training to follow like the check system of stepping back and assessing and regressing and getting the fundamentals down first, it can feel very frustrating to regress like that, not feeling like I'm getting as good a workout in, I'm not crushing myself with my training. But then when I actually did that and I stuck to it, I noticed that afterward, it took a couple of weeks, but then I started seeing my lifts increase and I felt stronger, and not just stronger, but more able across the movements.
Yeah, that's beautiful, man. And hearing you say that, like, there's multiple ways to measure progress. Like, I think starting out, for me at least, I was mainly measuring progress in the gym by the number on the bar. But if you start taking like a zoomed out perspective, and even though maybe that number in the bar doesn't go up right away, like what you're saying or whatever the measurement you're typically look like quantitative measurements.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at the program and the experience for a more qualitative perspective, then you might start noticing, wow, I've got way more awareness in my body, or wow, my back's not hurting as much when I do this, or wow, like I feel more balanced and more integrated. So we are in fact progressing, but it's oftentimes, can we open the aperture enough to actually see these other areas that are progressing? And then, like you were saying, there comes a moment and a point in time when actually those quantitative measurements, if it is the number on the bar that we're looking at, those go up, and they often go up much faster because we've got a more stable foundation to the house.
Yeah. That's actually exactly what it was for me too. After I'd made the changes, I realized that my back wasn't sore in a painful sore kind of way afterwards that I always just assumed was part of heavy back squats, for example. Heavy back squats with the lifting shoes on, with the weight belt and all these things I was using to compensate. And after I changed that, all of a sudden it went away and I felt a healthy sore afterward instead.
That's really cool to hear. Yeah, that makes total sense. And I hear that in different ways and have experienced that a lot. Yeah.
What do you recommend? Because I looked on your site and it seems like you offer multiple programs that involve kettlebells. Are there any particular ones that are best suited for beginners and then maybe someone on the more intermediate advanced level?
So the two main programs that anyone can buy right now that are up on my site is something called Mastering the Kettlebell. That's one program. And then Kettlebell Lifestyle. And they complement each other. Mastering the Kettlebell is, and I say this at least to the best of my knowledge, I don't know of any other program that is more comprehensive in that. There's over 400 videos in there. Like I went crazy for 13 months in there. And it's like 2 to 3 levels worth of information of certifications. So assessments on each movement, common errors and fixes, progressing into all of the major kettlebell lifts, coaching tips, program design, lectures on posture in the spine. Like it is a deep, deep, deep resource. That's probably the coaches, like the Czech practitioners, will really appreciate the level of detail if you want to coach and you want to learn the nuances. Kettlebell Lifestyle, on the other hand, I teach a lot in it. Every single exercise in there has a full-blown tutorial, 3, 4, 5 minutes. And that one is more of a follow-along workout program where you learn as you go as well. So Kettlebell Lifestyle was designed for beginners to intermediate people. And just like we were saying, it starts off intentionally very slow. I think week one is all working in. Maybe like one very basic workout, very basic learning mobility training, learning a corrective stretching program. There's a personalized stretch test in there. Again, there is working in. There's a kettlebell selector tool, which will take into account fitness level, skill level, body weight, gender, and give you your preferred kettlebells to do the program with. So that program, you will learn via your workouts and all the tutorials. And that is more of a complete holistic system. That would be the very next thing to working with me in person. Mm-hmm. The program modifies based off of, you take a questionnaire each time you do a major workout starting in phase one, not in the beginning phase, the prep phase, let's say. But you take a 5 question questionnaire, which takes like 15 seconds, and your training volume in that workout modifies. Nice. So if you're super stressed, it might reduce your volume, your number of rounds in the circuit by half. And if you're really stressed on that day, for example, it'll tell you, do your working in exercise, do your corrective stretching program. So I wanted to give a program that is as close to what I do in person as humanly possible. And that's why it took 9 months to build that out custom with coding and all that sort of stuff. So those are the two programs. But I will say, just to iterate once again, if you really want to learn and really learn a lifelong approach and go slow in the beginning, be methodical, and get as close as you can to working with me as possible, Kettlebell Lifestyle is a great program. If you're just looking for workouts that change every single day or that kick your ass or what, it's not the program. But for those that want to empower themselves to learn and study and who love this stuff, like especially Czech practitioners, those are the people that really, I think, appreciate the level of care and the thoughtfulness and the rationale and can understand the different phases and understand, like, if we want to go far for a long time, then we need a little bit more thoughtful approach. And that's what that program is.
Mike, I love that. You've really gone and you're giving people tools to metaphorically fish for the rest of their lives once they go through the program. Even though I haven't done any of them, it sounds right up my alley. And since I haven't done that much kettlebell work, I do a couple movements that include the kettlebell. I think this would be a good one for me to investigate at some point.
Yeah, man. I think you'll really, being a Czech practitioner, Czech practitioners are really unique people. They're, in my experience, I mean, I am one. They are investigators. They're curious. They want to know the why. They appreciate thoughtfulness and I mean, so much. I mean, the main inspiration for that program, Kettlebell Lifestyle, was my coaching with Paul. 2.5 years working with him. And so he's actually in there. You get, I think, 2 lectures from Paul as you go through the program. I've got other lectures from other, you know, Czech faculty, Warren Williams. There's a few other great guys in there, and it's, for the Czech practitioner, it's a phenomenal, for anyone, I think it's a phenomenal program, but you really got to want to learn and invest in the education, and people who love Paul's work, like myself, geek out on this stuff for sure.
Awesome. Well, Mike, I know you have to bounce in a second, so we will start to wrap this one up. And before I ask you the final question, before the rapid fire round, where can people connect with you online, try your programs, work with you, that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So if anyone's interested in these programs, I also have a free gift now. It's on my website. It's called the Kettlebell Roadmap. There's exercises and plans for like 4 different phases. So people can download that for free. If you go to mikesalemi.io, not.com, I think you'll scroll to the bottom for that gift, or just go to Instagram, which I'm often on, mike.salemi, hit the link in my bio. You can download that free guide. I lead breath work. I lead all sorts of men's development work. So my website or Instagram is great, or YouTube, which is just my name as well. And yeah, I would say that's probably the best place to find me if people want to learn more and reach out and work with me.
Cool. Yeah, this will be topic for a different conversation, but you convinced me to join a men's group here locally in Austin. So that's been a profound change in my life recently. So thank you for mentioning that you're interested in that last time we spoke.
Yeah, awesome, man. That's great to hear. Hell yeah.
If there was a burning of the books and all knowledge on earth is gone, you get to save the works of 3 teachers, who would you choose and why?
I mean, the first one that comes up automatically is Paul's book, How to Eat, Move, and Be Healthy. I would say either that or his 4 Doctors book. For sure. I feel like that is the blueprint. How to Eat, Move, and Be Healthy. That is the blueprint that we all need to know to thrive as human beings. And if we don't have that tool set, like I've had my mom take holistic lifestyle coaching, which is based off of his book, How to Eat, Move, and Be Healthy. Anyone who is a human needs that book. So without a doubt, I would say him in that book. 2 others. Another one that comes up is from Dr. Marshall Rosenberg, which is nonviolent communication. So that's now in the realm of relationships. And so if you're a human being, like everybody is here who's listening to this, relationships are one of the things that I think make for the most challenging aspects of being human and also the most beautiful aspects of being human. Relationships, of course, the relationship with ourself, but the relationship with intimate partners, with family members, with colleagues and coworkers and professionally and all that sort of stuff. So the focus on communication, which is in that book, it's a beautiful book. It's either called, they use it interchangeably, but compassionate communication or nonviolent communication. Any of those 2 by Dr. Marshall Rosenberg, phenomenal book. So I would use that one. And then the 3rd book, what comes up is something around money and finances. And that really, really has, so The Psychology of Money, I don't recall the author, but The Psychology of Money is a really good book, because so much of our root chakra, our sense of safety, security, tribal association oftentimes is tied to our financial, our relationship with money and our psychology around money. Yeah. And so, I mean, we all today have to pay something to live, you know, unless we're being a monk or whatever. But at the same time, especially if we want to have a family, all that sort of stuff, finances is also one of the number one causes of divorces in relationship and that sort of stuff. So I would say the psychology of money, or a solid financial book and understanding ourselves around that, that book is phenomenal. Paul's book for the health of the well-being, and then also a book that can help you in communications. Mm-hmm. I think with those three books, you'd be pretty solid. I mean, you could go into other books that are very philosophical. Actually, I'm going to throw in one more if that's okay with you. The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. That one's a beautiful one for, I would say, like developing your inner code. And there's some pearls of wisdom that we can learn from that. So any of those three or four books are kind of like, I would say, if there was a burning of the books, I would go with those three to four for sure.
Beautiful. Sounds like you're a reader. And because we're very low on time, we're going to skip the rapid fire round, save that for a later date. And I'm going to hand over the mic to you. Are there any parting thoughts or takeaways you'd like to leave listeners with?
Oh man. We talked a lot about movement today. And so let's use that as an example. With your movement practice, an invitation to get out of your head so much potentially and more into your body and into your heart. And so whether it's working in or the walks or trusting the program that you're on, feeling your body moving through space and time and being attuned to when we are acting in excess and depleting ourselves, or when we're acting in lack or deficiency and we actually need to kick our own ass and actually work out, for example. And so if we can approach this concept of working in, working out, yin and yang, and have that understanding of where we are when we wake up in the morning, my invitation would be to be a little less in the head, more in the heart, more in the body, more sensitive to how we are experiencing movement as a tool to help further our goal, to help further our dream, as opposed to utilizing movement as an escape. Mm-hmm. That would be, yeah, that's what's coming up right now.
Well, that's a great way to wrap this one up. Mike Salemi, thank you so much for joining me today on the Mind Body Peak Performance Podcast.
Super welcome, brother. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, take care. Thank you for tuning in to this episode. Head over to Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and leave a rating. Every review helps me bring you thought-provoking guests. As always, you can find the show notes for this one at mindbodypeak.com/ and then the number of the episode. There, you can also chat with other peak performers or connect with me directly. The information depicted in this podcast is for information purposes only. Please consult your primary healthcare professional before making any lifestyle changes.